opportunity and was appointed ambassador in 1968. He has resigned amid speculation that he will enter the race for governor of Maryland. We'll have the first questions now from Richard Valeriani of NBC News.
Mr. Schreiber, before we speculate about your political future, I'd like to ask about your diplomatic past. After President Pompidou's visit here, and even before it, we heard a great deal from Paris and from the White House about the improvement in Franco-American relations. Have relations really improved in any meaningful way, or is this just a matter of cosmetics?
No, I think they have improved in a meaningful way. First of all, for example, as you know, the French government is now open to the idea of Britain's entry into the common market. That's a significant change, a very substantive change in the position of the French government. President Pompidou himself on a number of occasions has said that he is not only willing but happy to have England in the common market. Second, the French position has changed in the international monetary and finance field. Two or three years ago, as you know, also they were refusing to participate in the special drawing rights program of the International Monetary Fund. They're now in it. They were refusing to use the credits from the International Monetary Fund a few years ago. Now they're using them. The finance minister of France is having frequent contacts now with the Secretary of the Treasury here and with the finance minister in Great Britain. So in that important area, they're substantially different. They're different also in the scientific area. Recently, a treaty, practically a treaty, a new agreement was reached between France and the United States to improve research in science, the exchange of scientists, the exchange of information in science, and I could go on in various fields, whether it's in the intelligence field or other fields, to indicate that it's been a substantial change.
Well, I notice you do not mention the political field. In spite of the improvement, the French sold jets to Libya without consulting with the United States and apparently even misinforming you, to use the polite word. And then just last week, after Pompidou's visit, the French called for an international conference on Indochina, on Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, again without even consulting or apparently informing the United States. Now, this does not indicate a substantial rapport, does it?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I didn't mention the political field. You're quite right, but I could have, because in fact, the French government, the political end of the government, is consulting with us more than they ever have in the last decade. Now, it's true they don't always agree with us, and we don't agree with them, but that doesn't mean they don't consult with us. Secondly, let me say that, you know, the French government doesn't have any requirement that they have to talk to us about everything they do before they do it. We don't talk to everybody before we do some things. So, as a sovereign nation, they're not required to do that. But the fact is that the level of communications, the consultation between the French government and the political area and our government is greater now than ever before, that is, within the last 10 years.
But in a case involving something as vital to the United States as Vietnam and a conference on Indochina, wouldn't it be almost a matter of courtesy to inform us before suggesting an international conference?
Well, I don't necessarily think that you have to do that. In fact, I personally like the idea that the French have proposed that we attempt to get an international conference to consider all of Indochina. And I noticed that General Ky, who has been looked upon as a sort of a hard right-winger, I think, in the Vietnamese government, Vice President Ky, came out in favor of that just yesterday, in favor of the French idea of trying to get a conference which would bring peace to all of Indochina, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. And personally, I would hope that there was a good possibility for such a conference and that if held, it would be successful.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll be back with Meet the Press and more questions for our guest, Sergeant Schreiber. First, this message.
The Crusade Against Drunk Drivers, a progress report. I'm Ed Reimers to report on an encouraging example of a team effort that worked. To help arouse public interest, these Allstate messages began appearing just a little over a year ago. Some carried coupons, so citizens from coast to coast could show their support of governors and legislators trying to get much-needed drunk driving laws on the books. Over 500,000 people sent in coupons to their governors. Over 1 million of these action booklets have been distributed. But more important, drunk driving laws that meet the standards of the National Highway Safety Act were passed in 16 states. That's a beginning, but there's more to be done. Will you help get drunk drivers off the road? To find out how, send for a free copy of Drunk Drivers and Highway Safety, Allstate Insurance Companies, Northbrook, Illinois.
Now back to Meet the Press, an unrehearsed press conference. Here's our moderator, Edwin Newman.
Resuming our interview on Meet the Press, our guest is Sergeant Shriver, who recently retired as United States Ambassador to France. You've just met Richard Valeriani of NBC News. The other questioners on our panel are Philip Potter of the Baltimore Sun, John L. Steele of Time and Life, and Robert J. Donovan of the Los Angeles Times. Lawrence E. Spivak, regular panel member, is on vacation. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Potter.
Mr. Shriver, you have initiated a meeting next Friday with Governor Mandel of Maryland. Will you tell him that you plan to run against him for the Democratic nomination this year, or are you going to offer your advice on whether he should veto or approve a new bill passed by the legislature that would make abortions as easy to get in Maryland as tonsillectomies?
Well, I'm not going to do either of those things. I'm paying a courtesy call on the governor, just as I have called on a number of other leading political people in the Democratic Party in the state of Maryland. I waited until the session of the legislature was over because I didn't want to impose upon the governor's time during that rather hectic period at the end of the legislature before I asked for an appointment. But I have no intention of doing either of the things that you suggested. In fact, I think it would be rather presumptuous.
If you were the governor and you had such a bill before you, would you sign the new abortion law or veto it?
I tell you, I think that if I had been the governor, I would have been laboring pretty hard to get a better bill than the bill that passed.
In what respect?
In a lot of respects. I think that to grant a person an abortion may solve the problem of the pregnancy that that particular girl has at that particular moment, but it's not going to solve the problems that brought about that pregnancy. I, for example, am against the idea of trying to legislate morality. I was against, a long time ago, the 18th Amendment, and frankly, I don't think that it's necessary to have laws about abortion today. There are many Catholic priests, for example, who maintain the same position. One is actually running for the Congress in Massachusetts. So it's not a religious issue. I believe that if you repeal the abortion laws, at the same time, you should add new statutes to provide psychiatric guidance, for example, in counseling, to provide better family planning information, to provide better child care clinics, to provide better education across the board about child health and human development, so that people have a better understanding of their responsibilities as citizens, what it means to be a parent, what it means to raise a family, so that the possibilities for unwanted pregnancies would be reduced. I don't think that a mere abortion law by itself addresses the problem of abortion adequately. So I would be in favor of a much more comprehensive program the program in that statute.
Excuse me, Mr. Steele.
Mr. Shriver, do I take it from your answer to Mr. Potter that you would veto the legislation that was passed, the abortion law?
No, what I said was that if I was governor, I would try to get a package of legislation, a package of bills. For example, when we repealed the 18th Amendment, we made alcohol widely available. I believe we should have passed a lot of additional legislation to control alcoholism and to help alcoholics. I'm trying to suggest by analogy that with abortion we should do the same thing. Merely to legalize abortion does not solve the problem of abortion. We need to do a great deal more of the type of thing I was just describing.
The governor of Maryland is faced with a fact. He has a law on his desk that he must veto or sign or let go into law. Would you veto it or would you sign this law?
Actually, that's not the case in this. This particular bill is also subject to a pocket veto because it was passed on the last day of the legislature. He does not have to sign it.
Well, what would you do if you were governor?
I've just told you what I would do.
Not read this law.
What's that?
Not regarding the law that was passed last week by the legislature.
Yeah, what I would do would be, if I signed the law, then I would demand that a whole comprehensive series of additional laws be put into operation to help the people who are facing abortions. The mere passage of this bill doesn't really help anybody, because the current legislation in Maryland is more than adequate to take care of the people who need abortions. But the problem isn't a single thing about one abortion bill. The problem is as big as alcoholism, for example, and requires a great many ancillary actions.
Are you going to run for governor?
I haven't made any decision on that. As a matter of fact, Larry Spivak, the permanent moderator of this program, said to me,
"We're going to give a tax break to parents whose children attend non-public schools, parochial schools. How do you feel about state aid to parochial schools or this version of a tax break?"
This question has come up before and is not novel or original. It's being studied by the commissioner that Dr. Crashour is heading. That's one of the aspects that they're looking into for their recommendations. I feel that in this area, there's no question that some form of aid has to be given. The question is, the recommended form of aid has to be done in a form that, one, is constitutional, and two, that is fiscally possible. And this is what the commission is studying at the present time. The whole area of constitutionality will be up for consideration by the Supreme Court in this fall term. We'll get an answer to that. There's various decisions around the country, both ways, holding some programs constitutional, others unconstitutional. But we will get an answer from the Supreme Court in this fall term. And then the fiscal question is one that we will have to get from the commission that's studying it. We have both the commission and our Committee on Economic Advisors looking into this area.
One school question the Supreme Court is expected to rule upon will be the one of school busing. How do you hope the court goes on that one, Governor? What are your feelings on that?
As far as the question of busing itself is concerned, I don't know the precise question that will be before the Supreme Court. Busing has not proven successful. It has not worked. It has not solved the problems and doesn't appear to be the answer to the problem. Fortunately, in our state, from the very day that the Supreme Court decision was originally announced, our state went into a total question of integration, and we have had very few areas where there's been any problems. And we hope that it continues that way. But as to busing itself, even those who originally, and I've discussed it with people who are very much for it, even those who originally suggested itself that it has not accomplished the purpose that it was intended to accomplish.
Bob? Governor, gun control was a big campaign issue, or at least an emotional campaign issue in the Senate campaign. Now that you're running with the Senator, that will rub off on the state ticket. How do you stand on gun control?
The state of Maryland adopted its own laws on gun control over the last 3 years. There's been each session bills on gun control. We have in Maryland a gun registration law for the state of Maryland that affects hand weapons. Anyone that wishes to purchase a hand weapon in the state of Maryland has to make an application, and within 7 days that application is checked by the state police. If they find that the individual has a criminal record, has a record of insanity, he is not permitted to buy the gun. So that we feel that this law has worked very effective in the state of Maryland, and we don't have any major problems. And I don't think that the law that we have in the state is going to need any great change to keep it working efficiently.
Do you feel that there's no great problem in campaigning with Senator Tynings and on the issue of gun control?
No, as you must realize, and everyone must realize, all of us as individuals have our own feelings about issues. We may disagree, and I'm not saying that we do, but we may disagree on single issues. But in the overall picture, we feel that the Democratic Party is the party of the people to serve the people, and it's better for the people.
I'm sorry, but time is up. Our guest has been Governor Marvin Mandel of Maryland, who is seeking re-election in November.
That it might split the party and permit a Republican to take not only the governorship but the senatorship this year. Is that a matter of concern to you?
Well, it's a matter to which I certainly would give consideration, no question about it. I don't mean to just dismiss that argument as if it was of no substance. However, I believe that it would not come about what you've just described.
What?
And I believe also that the question as to whether we have an open primary and whether in the Democratic Party people, the Democrats, have a chance to choose between alternative candidates, I think that's very important. In Maryland, as a matter of fact, the Democratic Party has just changed the way in which it will select the delegates to the next Democratic National Convention. They want to have an open primary. I agree with that principle, namely that the people, the members of the party, should have a chance to choose between alternatives. In this case, as you know, the current incumbent governor was not ever elected by the people of Maryland. He never went through a primary selection. He was, in fact, a sort of a coalition candidate. All the Republicans, I believe, or nearly all the Republicans, for example, in the state legislature, voted for him to be the governor. I think that the open primary system is basic to our whole concept of American democracy. And therefore, I think it's worthwhile for people to offer themselves for public office in primaries. And I think that that should happen in Maryland, whether or not I get into the primary or not.
Many people seem to think that he's done a better job than expected and has a progressive record in protecting consumer interests, the environment, What do you think about his record, and what issues would you raise against him if you do run against him?
Well, I think you're quite right. A lot of people do think he's done a better job than expected.
What do you think he's done, Joe? How do you think about his job?
Well, I read that handout that Joe Napolitan put out about the program, the governor's, and it was a very comprehensive handout.
You think you could do a better job of implementing it?
I think that's a question for the voters in a state, in this case in the state of Maryland, to decide. What they ought to do is look at the record of one man and put it up against the record of another man, the prospects for the future as exemplified in the personality and leadership of one man versus another man. I think they ought to have that range of choice. I've just come from Europe, as you know. In fact, I was in Romania and a couple of countries behind the Iron Curtain, and there they don't have any choice. They just get a chance to vote for one man in the primary, so to speak. They think that's democracy. I don't think it is. I think that one of the inherent qualities of American democracy is freedom of choice and a range of choices. So therefore, I think it is in keeping with our most fundamental beliefs in this country to have alternatives in the primary.
Mr. Shriver, you mentioned Joe Napolitan. Who is he?
Joe Napolitan is a man who was announced in newspapers recently as working as a public relations consultant and advisor to the governor of Maryland.
Mr. Steele.
Mr. Shriver, you said you have not made up your mind yet as to whether you will run for governor. Yet I received a very pleasant invitation the other day to a welcome home party for you, and I thought that was very fine. Then I read in the lower left-hand corner, $750 per person. It sounds like you're raising a campaign chest. Is this for campaign expenditures?
Well, it ought to be a lot more than that if you're trying to make a campaign chest. You know that. Usually if you go to a political dinner, it's $50 or $100. I've even heard of dinners at $1,000.
Well,
that's a nice welcome home party. Who do you think is going to pay for it?
Well, it looks like I am, but $750.
I hope you come.
$750 to some of us is quite a bit of money. What's the money for?
Well, I didn't arrange the party. I'm not a host, but I imagine they're trying to defray the cost. Excuse me, the cost of food, entertainment, liquid refreshment, perhaps.
Mr. Shriver, when will you make
that? They have a lot of newspaper men there. They might even raise it up a little bit more than that, perhaps.
I'm afraid that wouldn't go. Mr. Shriver, when do you plan to make up your mind as to whether you will or will not run for office?
Well, what I'm going to do, as you know, I've only been back recently. I'm going to spend some time traveling around the state, talking to people, ordinary citizens as well as the leaders, newspaper people, radio and television people, businessmen, labor leaders, and so on. And make a decision on the basis of what I hear from them about the needs of the state and about whether my candidacy, if I ever were to announce one, would be effective or useful for the state. I haven't decided yet what to do, but I am seriously considering that possibility.
Mr. Shriver, since you've been away, many people think that the Democratic Party has fallen on evil states. They've not only lost the presidency, but the governorships of many large states and many state legislatures. In a moment, can you tell us what do you think the Democratic Party must do to reestablish its virility and its salability?
Well, I think it'd be very difficult to do that in a moment. It always is true that when a party's out of power, people say that it's in very bad shape. You remember that being said about the Republican Party, but they're back in power right now. When the party's out of power, that's an opportunity. It's a fluid situation for the party to look around for new leadership. And I think that's what's going to happen in the Democratic Party. And I hope that that does happen and that people compete for that leadership and that we do come up with a new candidate who will be successful in winning the presidency.
Mr. Donovan.
Mr. Shriver, doubtless you will recall 2 years ago there were numerous public reports that the followers of Robert Kennedy and the Kennedy family were very disgruntled that you did not return to support him for president in his bid for the presidential nomination. Do you, in view of those reports, have any hope that there could be a Kennedy backing for your candidacy in Maryland if you decide to run?
Well, I don't know whether there would be or not. Obviously, I hope that there would be. But let me just say for the record that although I'm sure what you say is true, that there were people who were disappointed, we did take the precaution at that time 2 years ago, before we accepted the position of going to Paris as ambassador, finding out whether Robert Kennedy was going to run for president. And at the time that I gave my word to President Johnson that I would go to France, and then he then asked for agreement from the French government, at that time Robert Kennedy said he was not running for the presidency. Having given my word, I felt I should live up to my word. I agree, however, that there were some people who were disgruntled about that, and I'm very sorry. However, I think that the vast majority of the people who were close to President Kennedy and to Robert Kennedy would look with favor upon my candidacy if I enter into a political campaign.
While I'm on this subject, can I just ask you one more question? Do you see, what do you see as a political future for Senator Edward Kennedy?
Well, I think he has a tremendous political future. First of all, he's a relatively young man. He's only 37, 38 years old now. Therefore, you can look forward to 20 years when he will be active in the political life of our country. I think he has worked extremely hard. He's very intelligent. He's got the finest kind of motivation for public service. I wish that there were 100 young men like Senator Kennedy, either in the Senate or in other legislative bodies around the country. I think that no one can predict the future, but I see a very rosy future ahead for Senator Kennedy, and I certainly wish him all possible success because I think his success would be helpful to our country.
Mr. Valeriani.
Speaking of age, Mr. Shriver, you are, I think, 54. Do you consider 1970 as your last chance for getting elected to an important office?
No, I don't think so. Why should I feel that? I may look 54, I may be 54, but I've noticed going around the world, for example, Konrad Adenauer never even got into public office till he was 60. He was exceptional, however.
Do you consider yourself a potential presidential contender in 1972?
I don't consider myself that, no. It's very flattering to have you mention it as even a possibility, but I'm not looking ahead to 1972 now.
May I just break in here, Mr. Shriver? You said a while ago that Lawrence Spivak, who's the regular panel member on this program, had asked you not to say whether you would run for governor of Maryland on this program. That is what you said earlier in the program.
And I thought that's what he told me.
Mr. Spivak called to say that he thinks you must have misunderstood him, and he would not presume to tell you what to say on the program. I should add from my own experience that that sounded to me like a very uncharacteristic request for Mr. Spivak to make, that you not reveal your political intentions on the program. So if you had any inhibitions about revealing them because of what you thought Mr. Spivak said, please cast them aside.
Well, I'm glad Mr. Spivak is watching the program, and I'm sorry if I misunderstood him.
So would you care to state now what your intentions are?
I already have, I think.
You have?
Yes.
They are undetermined at this stage, is that right?
That's right. I said I'm not a candidate at this time for that particular position in the state of Maryland, that I am seriously considering the possibility of doing so. I was urged 4 or 5 years ago by Senator Tidings, for example, and by others in the political leadership of Maryland to run for governor of Maryland. I've been urged more recently than that by lots of Marylanders to do it. And now I'm back in the United States. I don't have any prohibitions against doing what I would like to do and what would be in the interest, I hope, of my family and of the people. And so I'm considering it.
About 2 minutes left, Mr. Potter.
Mr. Shriver, you suggested that you're not looking forward to 1972, but there's a lot of thought that you want the Maryland governorship as a springboard. I believe, and I may be inaccurate about this, that the term of governor is 4 years. If you are nominated and elected, will you promise to serve out the full 4 years, or will you pull a Spiro T. Agnew?
Well, let me just say, I would have every intention, if I run and if I'm elected, I have every intention, every possible intention to serve out the 4 years. Not only 4 years, but if I could get reelected, I'd like to serve out 8 years.
But you make no promise, I gather.
Well, I'm glad to promise it, but you can't promise things that you don't know what's going to happen in the future.
1 minute left, Mr. Steele.
Is there a problem about the residency requirement in Maryland so far as you're concerned in running for public office, sir?
That question was raised, and I have discussed it with the best legal counsel that I could get in the state of Maryland, one of the most eminent law firms in Baltimore. And they and all other lawyers that I've discussed this with have told me that I am eligible to run.
You, Mr. Donovan, that the time to get out of Vietnam is now. Is there anything you can do to promote that policy in this country, to get some backing behind that?
Well, I don't know. I can talk about it, which I intend to do, among other things. I can urge people in the State Department, I suppose, from the outside. I can urge them to take that position. I could write articles and so on.
Will you?
I can talk. Well, I don't have an intention to do all those things right now, but I think even discussing it on this program may be helpful. I hope so.
Sorry to interrupt, our time is up. Thank you, Ambassador Shriver, for being with us today on Meet the Press. I'll tell you about next week's guest in just a minute after this message.
Transportation fund approach to the problems of transportation. I think over a period of years, this is going to probably be one of the outstanding actions taken by the General Assembly this session.
Governor, the new racetrack bill signed benefit the track transportation.
Well, of course, the state will benefit from it to the tune of about $1.5 to $2 million. I think the benefit will be that we will keep first-class racing in Maryland by increasing the purses, the breeders' funds. I think in order to compete with Pennsylvania and the other states north of us, that this was necessary. We have increased these purses and the breeders' funds and the number of racing days to meet that competition.
Governor, do you feel the failure of the General Assembly to enact the measures that would have let Maryland participate in the Potomac River Basin Compact will have any long-term effect on efforts to control Potomac River pollution?
No, I don't think it will have any effect at all. I think that next year, with the legislature having the opportunity to study it over the summer, that next year it would probably be enacted by the General Assembly. But there was no great urgency at this time because a number of the other states who are participating in it, such as West Virginia, can't even consider it the next year. Pennsylvania has indicated that they're not going to act until Congress has approved the Susquehanna River Compact. So, as I said, there was no great urgency to act. It's given the legislature, though, an opportunity to study it, review it, and know the problems with it. And I think that over the summer, when they take it up, by next year, it'll be ready to pass the compact.
If you all have a minute, Mrs. Heiser, the Census Director, is going to officially present Governor Mandel with his census form. I'm anxious to know if they have running water in the mansion.
I want to see it when it's filled out. I don't want to see it when it's presented.
Hey, please. Hey, I'm not doing my table. Please, move the chair.
Oh, boy.
Anything for the question?
Today's census day, Governor.
I'm
honored to be able to present your census form in person.
Thank you very much.
I also wanted to thank
it.
You at this time for your recent statement in support of the census for the 1970s.
Yeah, I was glad to do that. I think it's very urgent that we have this kind of information even for our state workers.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I don't know. It looks like my income tax
it's a
return.
Short one.
Happy mail today.
What's that?
It doesn't have to be mailed today.
In the Annapolis area and the three southern counties, we are having census takers go door to door. We do not mail them in. The instructions are to hold them for a census taker.
Nobody would be able to get where I live.
That's why I'm bringing it to you.
Thank you very much. Almost completed, it's going to be opened in March or April, and I don't see how we can stop now.
Governor, have you seen the Republicans' legislative program yourself?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen it. Do they have one?
It came out this morning.
Oh, no, I haven't seen it. I'll be glad to take a look at it.
Bill.
Take me a little while to read all this. I can't comment.
So the first
one that you have, you got some notes on there.
The first one's a constitutional amendment to really take the responsibility of the estimating revenue out of the hands of the controller within the executive branch. Would you be in favor of having that comment?
I'm not quite sure. I shouldn't say this. I think. Today, I could have my own revenue estimates without having to have a constitutional amendment. So I don't think it's even needed. If it's just for the purpose of vesting that power in the executive, you have that. I have that power there, so there'd be no need for it. So
Thank you, Doug.
Governor.
So many of you were saying thank you. I don't think you really meant it.
This is a funny day.
I wanted to give to all of you, but I forgot all about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is not America, and this is not the fruit of education. Demonstration is quite necessary in countries where an autocratic form of government or a totalitarian dictator refuses to allow the people to make their wishes known and heeded through the general force of free elections. But this is not true in our country. And we're the majority of the people of this country. I've spoken in an election. To me, it is not salutary. It is not beneficial to the reasoned climate of a country that has projected itself, made its force felt.